Welcome to The Director's Chair, a Lowy Institute podcast. My name is Michael Fullilove and I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. On The Director's Chair, I sit down with the varied cast of international life, including political leaders, players and commentators, in order to understand what's happening in the world. The coronavirus pandemic is a global event of historic proportions. The world is facing a global health crisis, a global economic crisis, and perhaps further down the line, a global financial crisis. And our last line of defense is the Donald. I'm delighted that my guests today on this, the first episode of The Director's Chair, are two of the sharpest and most knowledgeable journalists covering Donald Trump's Washington. Susan Glasser is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where she writes a weekly letter from Washington. Her husband, Peter Baker, is the chief White House correspondent for The New York Times. Susan and Peter visited the Lowy Institute in 2018, and I thought it would be timely to speak to them now about COVID, the Trump administration, and America. Susan and Peter, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, Michael, thank you so much for having us. We are here in Washington, D.C., locked down with the rest of America and I guess pretty much the rest of the world. We're only a couple miles from the White House, but like everybody else, we're sort of watching this unfold in an endless series of Zoom calls and, endless televised briefings from the president himself. And, you know, I have to say it is an extraordinary thing to see how quickly our world here has been transformed. But you talked about a lot of different crises in the world. It's also clearly a crisis of governance and of politics, at least here in the United States. And I think that's one of the things that leaps out is that it is probably the gravest test that President Trump has faced or that any president in recent years has faced.
Well, let me ask you about that, because we're used to the United States as the epicenter of global power, not as the epicenter of global disease. And as you mentioned, President Trump prior to this probably hasn't faced an externally generated crisis. And now he has one, and it's a doozy. It's an enormous incident. So how is he faring? How would you assess President Trump's performance on the coronavirus curve to date?
Well, that's quite a loaded question. I mean, you know, give him 10 minutes and you'll hear something different from the president. So one of the most exhausting things, if you are a Trumpologist here in Washington, is trying to figure out what his policy and approach to this is on any given day. We were speaking on Monday. Yesterday was Easter Sunday in the United States. Remember, it was only on March 24th that the president said he wanted to have the country reopened and the church pews packed for Easter. Instead, we've reached the peak of the disease in New York City and the height of a crisis that has seen almost 2,000 Americans dying every day. We're number one in the world and not in a good way when it comes to the coronavirus at this point. You know, I think that it's been really painful in many ways to see that, you know, so many of the critiques that people have had of the Trump approach to the presidency are exactly the weaknesses that seem to be hampering America's response to this. And most particularly, of course, you know, the long delay in taking some of the necessary steps once there was the pretty clear information that this epidemic existed in China and that it was quite possible, if not likely, to come to the United States. There was a very long lag time when key steps were not taken that would have helped us be in a much better position today.
Peter, let me bring you in. The New York Times has done some incredible reporting on all the warnings that were sounded by the National Security Council and other elements of the US government and the president's tardiness. So can you tell us a bit about that reporting?
Yeah, I think that the president has said publicly, well, gosh, who could have imagined something like this happening? Well, it turns out everybody imagined that this was going to happen. His own administration imagined this was going to happen. They had a exercise just last year about what would happen. As the information began coming in from China, memos were written, meetings were held, phone calls were made. The president was amply warned about the possible consequences of this. And his reaction was that the people telling him this were alarmist. Alex Azar, who is his Secretary of Health and Human Services, once in mid-January and once again at the end of January, told him this is going to be a very, very serious issue. And the president responded by saying, you know, Alex, in effect, you're being an alarmist. So it took a while, I think, for the president to really quite absorb what he was being told. For a long time, he thought this was something that would just kind of wash its way through the system. This would be just like an ordinary flu. It would miraculously go away. And when his own advisors told him in mid-February that there's a series of actions you should think about taking to mitigate the interactions, social distancing, we're calling them, closing schools, stay at home, that kind of thing, it wasn't until mid-March that he embraced those actions after, in fact, many states like New York and California had already imposed them on their own.
And Susan, tell me about these long, rambling, narcissistic press conferences. Now that we're through that warning stage and we're into the response stage, typically leaders use these kinds of press conferences to provide information to the public. But President Trump seems to have a different vision for them.
Yeah, you know, he really does not see these as informational sessions. In fact, actually, I thought he made a very revealing comment at the one we just watched right before taping this conversation. The president said not once, but a couple different times that the goal of the briefings was to tell them what a great job we're doing. And he then even specifically said that to Steve Mnuchin, his Treasury Secretary. He said, Steve, go ahead, you tell him all the good things that we're doing. And so this is very explicitly a propaganda exercise, a validation exercise, an exercise in gratifying the very considerable presidential ego. It's really, you know, I compared it early on to in the United States during the Vietnam War era, there were the 5 o'clock follies, is what the American journalists in Saigon during the Vietnam War called the nightly press conferences at which the president, at which the Pentagon officials would, you know, sort of offer a very misleading and rosy portrait of the war, essentially always designed to distort and warp the ground truth with a series of often meaningless metrics that would show how they were winning. It seems to me that for Trump, that analogy has really held true, not only because he offers this sort of martial metaphors in talking about the invisible enemy and the war that he's now fighting, but also because he always has this very upbeat message, whatever it is. Tomorrow, the light is at the end of the tunnel. He even used that phrase in a very irony-free way, whereas Americans who remember history remember that that was exactly the phrase used by the final Vietnam commander, General Westmoreland, who said the light is at the end of the tunnel, and was then the subject of a famous libel suit in which he denied that he had said any such thing. And Trump, of course, seeming to ignore history if he had ever heard it. But, you know, so every night it goes on and on and on in an almost propagandistic dear leader sort of a way. It's not a disciplined, you know, half an hour or even an hour long press conference. These can go over 2 hours in a sort of extemporaneous, rambling stream of consciousness in which all the president's grievances and concerns are laid out. And they're very difficult opportunities, few often, for reporters to ask real and meaningful questions.
Let me ask a last question about President Trump's response, and then I want to broaden the discussion a bit. Peter, maybe I can bring you in. First of all, you've covered a number of presidents, first for the Post and then for the New York Times. So at a high level, how would you compare his crisis management response to other, if we can say, more normal presidents? And also, how is this something that intrigues me is how is the Secret Service protecting the president? We've historically known him as a bit of a germaphobe. He doesn't seem like that now. He doesn't like to wear a mask. He's happy to shake hands. But how are they protecting him from this virus? Because we've seen it strike down the British Prime Minister, and that can have an unbelievable effect on the government's response and also on public confidence in the administration.
Yeah, both good questions. I think if you want to know what a normal president or a different president would look like, look to Mike Pence, the vice president. If you take away the praise of, you know, President Trump, which he infuses into every answer, his responses are the way a different president, Republican or Democrat, would probably handle this. He would talk about the nature of the problem, would talk about, you know, the things Americans need to do to confront it, would be measured in his or her response to questions rather than quarreling, would talk about the, you know, resilience of the American people without seeming to dismiss the seriousness of the problem. What you see with President Trump is all of the jarring character traits that have been on display for 3 years and that may have worked for him in different circumstances when it was all about political infighting or what have you, but seem off key at a moment when a country is looking for straight talk and reassurance, where he's more focused on praise for himself or quarreling with anybody who might say something he doesn't like a governor or a reporter, where it's all about, you know, his own needs rather than expressing empathy for people who are dying and sick and losing loved ones across the country. He's done, you know, his strengths as a president have always been when he was fighting with somebody, right? He's very good at fighting. He likes to have an enemy, whether it be Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or Nancy Pelosi or even other Republicans like Mitt Romney. This is not something he can tweet away. He can't give the virus a funny nickname and humiliate it. He cannot bully it, cannot throw it into submission. And that's why the skills that brought him to the presidency are ill-suited to this particular moment.
I think Peter's point is a very good point about the lack of empathy. If you ask what has really leapt out at me in almost a month of these daily briefings, it is the fact that he almost never refers to the victims of this disease, the people who are suffering as a result of it, or even the, in a meaningful way, the healthcare workers who are risking their lives and first responders to do something about it. Just today, you listen to Pence talk about I think it's more than 22,000 Americans who are dead at this point. Trump, more than an hour that I listened, never said a word about the victims. You've never seen him dial into a hospital if he couldn't go there in person or do any kind of appearance with the people who are trying to make a difference in this. It's either tycoons and, you know, wealthy industry titans that he's appeared alongside or officials in his own government. And, you know, that is also something that I think is a real pronounced difference between the way that this particular president and any other leader of the United States at any other moment in time that in my lifetime, Republican or Democrat, of course, they would have actually emphasized the human aspect of this in ways that we've never seen, not once.
And in answer to your other question about Secret Service, I think they're deferring largely to the White House physician, which is, you know, understandable in this kind of circumstance. Remember, the president, of course, is setting his own rules. I was with him when he went to Mar-a-Lago just a little over a month ago for a party weekend. They had fundraisers. They had a birthday party for his son's girlfriend. There were hundreds of people there, the president of Brazil and all these hangers-on and senators and so forth, as if they had not a care in the world. And what we learned later, of course, is it was like a petri dish for the coronavirus. The Brazilian president and other people, you know, were exposed to it, were infected by it and so forth. And in the end, it felt like kind of a last tango, if you will, before the crisis really hit. And ever since then, the president has expressed a certain nonchalance about it. He says, I'm healthy. I'm not feeling bad. He doesn't express any great concern, despite the fact that he is a germaphobe, as you say. He's been tested twice and tested negative twice. They, for a while, were testing reporters who came into the White House with a thermometer before they would allow us in to make sure we didn't have a fever. Last Thursday, for the first time, they gave every reporter who came for the daily briefing one of those rapid tests for the coronavirus itself. And only those who tested negative were allowed in. I think everybody did test negative. And they were also doing that with aides and advisors and others who come in contact with the president these days. The West Wing itself is kind of skeletal. Not as many people are there right now, especially administrative staff have been sent home. But you're not seeing masks. They're not wearing masks for the most part. One of the few exceptions being Matt Pottinger, who's the deputy national security advisor and a China hawk, who early on thought this was going to be a big problem and didn't convince a lot of his colleagues about that.
Let me ask you, though, you paint a convincing picture of a president who is treating this virus like everything else, as though it's about him, who is not showing any empathy. And yet, despite the flaws in America's response to coronavirus, we don't really see that reflected in the polls, do we? I mean, recently, his polls hit an all-time high. They seem to have come off a little bit since then. But overall, he's doing pretty well in the polls, isn't he? I mean, how do we explain that? And what's your sense about his re-election prospects in November?
He is doing reasonably well in the polls, all things considered, especially given how much criticism he's gotten for his early response and how devastating some of the coverage has been. At one point, he was up to 49% approval rating, which is the highest he'd ever been in the Gallup poll. A majority supported his handling of the coronavirus for a time. Those numbers have begun to slide back down a little bit. They're back into the mid-40s or something like that. Now, they're not strong if you look at it historically in the sense of the rally behind the president effect, right?
Yeah,
when a president gets crisis, there's usually, you know, a much stronger support. For instance, after 9/11, George W. Bush went up to 90%. His father, after the beginning of the Gulf War, went up to 89%. You know, that has been the historic pattern. And President Trump, of course, is not getting anywhere near those kind of numbers. Whereas governors like Andrew Cuomo and scientists like Anthony Fauci have seen numbers in the 70s. They are, in fact, seeing that kind of bipartisan support. Having said that, the president is still in reasonable shape, according to the polls, when it comes to the general election in the fall. It's early. Nobody should take them too seriously. Joe Biden, who now, as of today, got the endorsement of Bernie Sanders and is obviously going to be the Democratic nominee, is up about 6 points in the national polling. But if you break that down into the states, it's closer. The states that matter. The states, for instance, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, the three states that really gave it to Trump 3 years ago, Biden's lead is 4%, 2%, and 1%. So it's a tight race. Especially,
although that's a lot of information from before this crisis began, and I do think, you know, sort of upended politics. But Peter's larger point is an important one. The partisan divisions in the country seem to be persisting, at least when it comes to the president's handling of this crisis, as they look at it. And that is in and of itself a big difference from America in its previous iterations. However, there are also new surveys that suggest that both Democrats and Republicans, large majorities, do support social distancing, and they do support staying at home and prioritizing that rather than, you know, acting hastily to reopen the economy. And, you know, there is a difference. So it's still a higher number of Democrats as opposed to Republicans who support that kind of policy. But still, it's something in this very partisan age that Americans, wherever they live and regardless of party, basically are supportive at this moment of the policies. You know, Trump is the most polarizing leader of our time in the United States, and views of him, it seems to me, you know, remain pretty fixed through this. The polls have been lagging, not leading indicators when it comes to trying to understand this, in part because Trump controls his, at least the part of the Republican Party that watches Fox News. He swings them to a remarkable degree. And actually, in a couple of the surveys I've noticed lately, they've started segmenting Republicans and then the smaller subset of Fox watching Republicans. And you will not be surprised to know that this form of self-reinforcing media bubble, or call it propaganda, whatever you want to call it, it really works. The numbers for Trump are so different, even among self-identified Republicans, between those who are Fox watching Republicans. They follow him much more closely.
What about Vice President Biden? As Peter mentioned, he's the presumptive nominee. He's got Senator Sanders' endorsement. There are, in some ways, you would expect coronavirus to play in his advantage, in the sense that he's a person of experience. He's been around through a lot of crises. He's got wisdom. On the other hand, he's also not a young man, and he's showing his age. And it also does seem to me that incumbency is so powerful in a crisis that the levers that a challenger has are less, and so much of it comes down to the incumbent's performance. So how is Biden doing in the last few weeks, and how are people feeling about Biden's strength as we head into the fall?
Yeah, I think you put your finger on it right. I mean, I think the president has completely dominated all conversation, all, you know, airwaves and everything. And Biden has had a hard time breaking through, sitting home at Delaware, sending out sort of like barely watched social media videos. And I think that's a challenge for him. On the other hand, it may not be a bad thing that he kind of goes underground for a little while. It allows him to rest. He is, as you say, showing his age a little bit. If he's kind of avoiding public gaffes and not having to travel around the country at a rigorous pace until a little later in the year, that might not be a bad thing for him. I think we don't know yet what the dynamics are going to be like when this election is settled, right? We can guess. But what is it going to look like in America in October? Are we going to be going through a second wave of illness in which economy still, you know, in a crater? Or will we beginning to see, you know, a resumption of normal life and some sort of economic trajectory that seems to be heading up? Will the president's approval take a hit because people grow tired of this? Or will he, you know, look like he is a winner because, as he seems to be trying to set up the expectations level, the death toll wasn't nearly as bad as the worst projections? And I think that, you know, it's hard to say. When Jimmy Carter first had the hostage crisis begin in Tehran, his numbers went up substantially for months. Americans supported him. People forget that. It was only after the passage of time that he began to look weak and ineffectual because he couldn't manage to get the crisis under control. And that's going to be the real trick for Trump. Can he have this under control, or at least appear to be under control in some sense by September or October?
Let me ask you about the broader American response to corona, if I can. Maybe, Susan, I can bring you in here. We've spoken a lot about President Trump, and I know he enjoys that, but let me move on from the president for just a second. How do we explain that the broader national response to coronavirus seems to have been lackluster in the United States compared to some other smaller, perhaps better run countries? Is it something to do with the running down of state capacity in the United States over the years, the federal system, perhaps the rugged individualism of Americans? What is it that explains it, and how might coronavirus change American politics? It is throwing an unforgiving light on your health system. It's perhaps changing the way people feel about frontline workers and the value that we should be according them as fellow citizens. So what explains the unimpressive performance to date, and how might coronavirus make American society better?
Well, those are great questions. Let's knock wood and hope that there's a positive behind the very sad and traumatic outcome that we're looking at right now. You know, look, it is a highly federalized system, even though we have 50 different states with very different economies and leadership and political cultures and all of those things. And it's not just two Americas. That's often how we talk about it in this day of political polarization. We're talking about red America and blue America, but geography comes into play, the different structure of the economy, as well as the different cultural and political factors involved. And so what I would say is that that's where leadership does come into play. So you saw that California has had a very different trajectory. And Washington State, even though it was very early on, one of the earliest centers of the coronavirus, has managed to much more aggressively and proactively get things under control. And yet you've seen here on the East Coast, New York City, not only a global city open to, you know, different people coming into it, but also a crowded city in which public transit is the lifeblood of the place. And also, by the way, where you had a mayor, a Democratic mayor, Bill de Blasio, who was as much of a denialist as Donald Trump was or as Boris Johnson was before he got the illness. Stupidity is not a partisan attribute. And we have politicians of both parties who ignore science and ignore expertise and do dumb things in a crisis. And frankly, you know, any reading of history suggests that that's true not only in the United States, but in any country in the world. And there are plenty of examples in Europe of screwing up. And so I think it would be a mistake to say that Donald Trump has a monopoly on foolishness in approaching this virus. You know, he has a lot of power in our system. And, you know, since 9/11 and the attacks on the United States, we did have a new culture of preparedness among our state governments. There was an entire department of Homeland Security was created in the United States as a specific recommendation of the 9/11 Commission. Then there were also departments of emergency preparedness that were created around the country. And so this was meant to be, a real step forward in our ability to handle a collective crisis like this. In some ways, parts of that system seem to have been working even when the federal government fell down, but it did fall down on the crucial moment of preparedness, right? So we don't know what's going to happen next. Maybe, you know, the ultimate story will be one where states and localities manage to overcome a slow and poor start by the president. But it is fair to say at this point that we know the early history, at least in its broad outlines of this crisis, and valuable time was lost to do exactly what these state governments and federal governments had been preparing to do since 9/11, which was, you know, get the testing going, get the equipment for hospitals that they knew they were going to need, put the orders in for those masks. We didn't do that. So looking forward, I think you'll see very diverging stories here, just as you see that tale of two countries between South Korea and the United States, which both had the first confirmed cases on the same day. And yet, of course, South Korea has had a radically different approach and much more success.
Susan, let me ask you, given that we're recording this podcast in the Asia Pacific, let me ask you about China and the politics of China. We see that the president is very quick to assign responsibility for the virus by calling it the Chinese virus or the Wuhan virus. I think that's probably a significant step in a way. It's interesting when you think back, you know, decades, a century later, we're still arguing about the causes and the responsibility for World War I. So these things are important in geopolitics. You kind of wish that the United States and China were cooperating in the middle of a global pandemic rather than throwing mud at each other. But how is the coronavirus altering the trajectory of US politics on China? It was already hardening, but it seems that it can only continue in that direction. Is that how it feels?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely hear a lot from Republicans and allies of the president right now about China taking a very hard line. This is something that Trump himself has actually veered back and forth. So at times he has called it the Chinese virus and the Wuhan virus. At times he has backed away from that after a phone call with Xi Jinping, for example. Remember, Trump still sees himself as wanting to make deals with China. So there's a sort of a pressure group in Washington, including inside his own administration. Peter mentioned Matt Pottinger, his National Security Council advisor, who was one of the earliest people warning about the coronavirus because it was seen as a threat from China. And so actually, ironically, you heard two different groups of people complaining early on about the coronavirus. One were Democratic senators who thought that the president wasn't doing enough. And then the other group were China hawks like Tom Cotton of Arkansas or Pottinger inside the White House or Liz Cheney, the daughter of the former vice president, another very hawkish member of Congress. They were the ones who were early on saying, hey, wait a minute, this is a big threat. Not because they are noted public health experts, but because they were coming at it from the vantage point of being China hawks who saw an opportunity to beat up on the People's Republic here. And so I think you'll see those pressures continue inside the Trump administration with Trump himself straddling both camps, as he has done, by the way, throughout the 3 years of his presidency so far. But, you know, in general, just to step back on the international politics of it, I do think it's a remarkable thing that you see a situation where the U.S. is so self-absorbed and inward-looking, a global crisis that is hitting essentially every country in the world simultaneously. And it, to me, it's just such a reflection of the changed world order that America is not leading at this moment. And of course, in part, that's because the president has always had a predilection for being a sort of a unilateralist and also for being very inward looking. He's continued, by the way, to bash our European allies at key moments throughout the crisis, as well as blaming China. He often launches into unprompted soliloquies about how much we've been ripped off by our allies, even in the middle of the pandemic. And so, you know, try to imagine what Jim Baker or Madeleine Albright would be doing in this moment. I assure you, they would not be sitting at home doing jigsaw puzzles, as Mike Pompeo has been, and complaining about the Wuhan virus to the G7 foreign ministers. They would be on the phone rallying international action and multilateral institutions in a way that the rest of the world, as well as Americans themselves, have come to expect from the United States. And that's just simply not happening here.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned jigsaw puzzles, because I want to finish on a positive note, if I can, Susan and Peter, and come down from the global summit to the experience that we're all living through. We're all in lockdown, and that has downsides as well as upsides. But can I ask you both, what have you each enjoyed about the lockdown? What are the positive you've taken away from it? There you are, you're a couple of miles from the White House, but you're not going to the White House much. So what have you, are there books you've read? Are there things you've watched? Or are there experiences that you're having because of sort of isolation life that you'd like to hang on to when we get through this?
Well, thank you for asking that question. I suppose a little positivity is a good thing. Your listeners might have heard Ellie the dog. So she's very happy that her humans are home with her and taking her on lots of walks throughout the day. In general, it's nice for all of us to be together here. You know, I did bake bread. I participated in that global trend. I might even do it again while the yeast holds out.
I've been the beneficiary of all the home cooking that's been happening here, which I have to say, we didn't realize just how much we were on the go until you had to actually sit at home every day, three meals a day, and try to figure out what you're going to do about them and how to clean the dishes.
Poor Peter's had a lot of dishes to do.
You know, look, it is a time for family in that sense. It is a reminder of what's really important. It's a reminder of how lucky we are, those of us who are not affected directly, that being at home and waiting for a few weeks or even months is not a great hardship compared the great suffering and tragedy that a lot of our fellow Americans and fellow citizens of the world are enduring right now. And so our personal experience has been a reminder of our great fortune, and knock wood, we'll all get through this at some point soon enough.
Thank you, Susan Glasser and Peter Baker, for sitting down with me today on the director's chair to discuss Donald Trump's Washington and America's response to the coronavirus. We really look forward to your future coverage of these issues in The New Yorker and The New York Times. So thank you very much. And in the meantime, please stay safe and well.
Thank you, Michael. You too. Stay healthy and make sure everybody knows how much you care about them.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's great to see your face. Although this is an audio conversation, we can see you as well. And we're glad that things are, knock wood, going okay down under.
You've been listening to The Director's Chair, a podcast by the Lowy Institute, hosted by me, Michael Fullilove, with production assistance from Madeline Neist. Listen to us on SoundCloud and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and please tune in to the next episode of The Director's Chair.